For today's episode, Dr. Richard Fry returns to share some updates with his research and clinical work. Dr. Fry is an MD, board certified in pediatrics, neurology, with special competence in child neurology, and is a certified principal investigator. In addition, Dr. Fry is a PhD in physiology and biophysics. This episode is all about leucovorin. Dr. Fry shares many great routes to learning more about leucovorin, including his upcoming book, Folate Fix, and two websites, Neurological Health Foundation and Healthy Child Guide. Please see the show notes for links to all of these wonderful resources. But first, a message about Daylight Computer and Chroma. I would like to take a moment and mention a pressing issue we are seeing in our modern world, and that is tech use and tech light. The data are impressive and concerning on isolated wavelengths of light, especially shorter wavelengths, which is blue light. For those that don't know, we have chromophores, which are special proteins that absorbs specific wavelengths of light. For blue light, the light that is LED light and tech light, that protein is called melanopsin. Melanopsin is responsible for our circadian biology, physiology and cell functioning, hormone regulation, and even a connection to an area huge for mood. A consideration we should include is this protein was not even discovered until 1998. It seems important for us to understand how our biology uses the different wavelengths of light for various aspects of our biology. This blue light chromophore is our master controller, our master clock. Remember, circadian rhythm is a two-part process, two independent parts, light and dark. For a quick reference, see the 2017 Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine. But for now, I have something exciting. I want to introduce a product unlike any other product available. A highlight is the product from Daylight Computer Company created their product based on these factors. The Daylight Computer is completely blue light free. It has no flicker. Short wavelength flicker is extremely harmful for our eyes and downstream biology. Light flicker is constantly turning our central nervous system on and off. Essentially, it is like going to a light switch and repeatedly turning it on and off. The problem is, blue light and LED light does this, and it is so rapid, you cannot even perceive this in real time. The Daylight Computer is the lowest stimulation and foremost for sensory sensitive users. It is no question that the alternative product, especially when used at night, do not address or consider this in their product. It is so toxic to human biology. Big tech corporations have patents on how their short wavelength implicate the human nervous system. And a bonus, despite Daylight Computer not having backlight, it is very functional for outdoor use. And of course, increased sunlight is always preferred. I am happy to offer a discount for the Daylight Computer. You can use the code AUTISM for a $25 off coupon. Again, use the code AUTISM and the discount code for $25 off. See the link in the show notes to Daylight Computer Company, or just give it a quick search in your internet browser. Use the code AUTISM for $25 off. I would like to mention Chroma, lights designed for humans. Chroma, a Seattle-based innovator founded by ex-NASA and Air Force engineer Michael Shapiro, is on a mission to enhance physical and mental health with purpose-built devices, unlocking peak human health, cognitive function, and performance. Shapiro launched Chroma to restore the natural light lost to screens in indoor living, and delivers faster recovery, sharper minds, and better sleep. Their products hit hard. The Iron Forge speeds muscle repair with red and near-infrared light, while the Skylight mimics sunlight to boost sleep and energy. A standout, the Forge Lamp, is a portable gem that fires 660 nanometer and 850 nanometer light to energize mitochondria and heal tissues on the go. Remember the four red light chromophores on cytochrome C oxidase, frequently talked about in the podcast. This is why. Their products are built with military grade durability that have lasting impact. Chroma's tech fuses precision and power. Gallium titride power supplies, smaller, cooler, and stronger than silicone, provide flicker-free light that's easy on the eyes. High-powered LEDs target key wavelengths for skin, tissue, and cellular health, with smart heat management for the lasting impact. Every design decision Chroma makes serves a purpose: to create devices that are precise, durable, and effective for improving human life. Remember, humans use different wavelengths of light for different functions of life. Remember when I ask, what do you think light is? Chroma designs with our biology in mind, from sleep aids and wound healing to mitochondrial energy, full body lights and blue light blocking glasses. They are US made, and Chroma ships globally and accepts FSA and HSA payments. Use AUTISM at checkout for a 10% off discount. That's AUTISM at checkout for a 10% off discount. Dr. Fry, thank you for joining again. I'm super excited about this and the recent news with Luca Voren.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm glad that there's some interest in this. We've had a lot of success, and I hope that other people can have the same success.
This is a great opportunity, I think. Luca Voren seems like it might be one of those low-risk, high-reward type of things as well. Meaning if somebody uses it and if it doesn't work, then there's not a really bad side effects. Is that pretty accurate?
Yeah. I mean, it's a type of folate, and we know folates are pretty safe long-term. They're, natural vitamins. And one of the great things about B vitamins, so folate is vitamin B9. And so the B vitamins in general are what we call water soluble, which means you pee them out at the end of the day. So your body has a natural mechanism for controlling, how much you have. So, so that's really good. The worst thing you do, what we say is the worst thing you do is make expensive pee.
Okay. I've heard that with bodybuilders, and people take vitamins and supplements and so forth. And it's just
some people would just say it's just expensive pee and so forth. So I like that. It's kind of like a intranasal oxytocin is kind of like that too with autism, but it doesn't have great success. And it seems like the leucovorin has better success. Can you just start with how you discovered leucovorin as a possible treatment option for autism?
Sure. You know, I'll briefly kind of tell you guys the story, you know, of the discovery kind of leucovorin as a treatment, because it's kind of interesting. So what we know, not to start out technical, but what we can see here is a brain. And this was, of course, we know is important. This controls how we think and how we move. But to get into the brain, everything that goes into the brain has to be actually selected to go in there, because the brain is a very, very controlled environment. So we have this thing called the blood-brain barrier. When you have your blood over here, these are your red cells going through, you know, your vessels, things can't just go into the brain. There's this barrier here that selects all the molecules that actually go in there. And so that's a good and bad thing, right? You know, that if you don't get things in there that are not supposed to be in there. But the other side of it is that you have to have these special carriers to bring things into the brain. If they weren't working, you know, that's a problem. You know, you don't get what you need into the brain. So one of the things that we know that is really important is folate, okay? And many people think of folate, 5-methyltetrahydrofolate is kind of our main folate in our body. And so that has to be brought into the brain. And there's really specialized mechanisms. You know, the body is very complex. So there's this thing called the folate receptor alpha, which you can see here. And here's the blood vessel here. And here's the brain, the cerebral spinal fluid. And so this receptor actually binds onto folate and it pulls it across and dumps it into the brain. And this is really important, because the amount of folate in the brain, the concentration, is 2 to 3 times higher than it is in the blood. So this is actually doing work and pulling folate into the brain and dumping it, you know, from the vessels into the brain, and doing a lot of work. There's other ways of getting folate into the brain. We have something called the reduced folate carrier over here, but you can see that it's smaller than the folate receptor alpha, and there's a reason for it. It just doesn't like folate as much. You know, you could think of the folate receptor alpha as kind of a fire hose, and the reduced folate carrier as a straw. So we really want this to work well. So we know folate is really, really, really important, okay? And so really folate is one of the most important vitamins for a number of different reasons, okay? We have something called the folate cycle, which is here. And it does a number of things. It processes folate in a number of ways for the body. You know, first you have the stuff on the left-hand side, and that is where folate makes something called purines. And those are the building blocks of certain genetic material, RNA and DNA. So we know if you don't have folate, you're not going to make RNA and DNA well, and that's our genetic code. So you actually can get genetic abnormalities if you don't have folate available. Folate is also important for making something called BH4, or tetrahydrobiopterin. And that's really important for making neurotransmitters, serotonin, melatonin, dopamine, norepinephrine, and for nitric oxide production. And there's a really interesting, you know, phenomenon with BH4 and why it's so important. And that is, for nitric oxide, you know, we've heard good and bad things about nitric oxide. You know, some people say it's toxic, some people say it's good. Well, you know, for the most part, it's a good molecule in our body. But one of the things that happens is if you don't have BH4, when it's being made, instead of making nitric oxide, you actually make a toxic molecule called a peoxynitrate. So the same pathway that produces nitric oxide, when you don't have BH4, which it needs for nitric oxide production, it ends up, it doesn't stop. It keeps trying to make nitric oxide, but if you don't have BH4, it actually makes a toxic molecule. So BH4 is extremely important. And then it's important for something called ATP, which is important for the mitochondria, the powerhouse of our cell, to make energy. And ATP is the energy currency of our cells. On the other side is what a lot of people talk about is methylation. And so on the other side of the folate cycle, you have methylation, where you use B12 and folate to make methyl groups. And those are important molecules that regulate if DNA is turned on and off. So that's really important, right? Every cell in your body has the same DNA. So how do the cells work differently? Well, it's because in certain cells, the DNA is turned on or off. And that's all due to methylation. So if methylation isn't working, you're in trouble. And it ends up that this then goes into what we call redox metabolism or transsulfuration to make glutathione, which is your major antioxidant of your body. So you can see folate is really central to all of these different things. Some of the nuances here is that we have the MTHFR, and a lot of people like to talk about the polymorphisms, that is small changes that make it more or less efficient. And so it may be more or less efficient at making 5-methyltetrahydrofolate, which we think of as our main folate. And then that will interfere with methylation. You also have to realize that we need folate over here. This is 5-10 formalin folate. That's where leucovorin comes in. And that goes to this other side. So it's a very complex pathway. The great thing about leucovorin and folinic acid is that the gut actually turns half of what's made of leucovorin when you take it orally to 5-methyltetrahydrofolate. So you actually have folate coming here and over here. So you kind of bypass the MTHFR, which is a good thing if it's not working all that well. The other really important thing, concept in folate, is that folic acid, which we all know of, we think that that's our great type of folate, is a synthetic form of folate. It's not natural. So our body can't use it naturally. And it has to go through something called the dihydrofolate reductase enzyme to change it from folic acid into tetrahydrofolate for it to be used. And there's two problems there. One, some people have changes in the dihydrofolate reductase enzyme that makes it less efficient. And two, we only have so many of these. So the idea of giving more folic acid, right? You want to get more folate in the body, you say, I'll just give more folic acid. But you can't do that because there's a limitation here, right? There's a bottleneck because you only have so much of this enzyme. So you only can, change so much folic acid into tetrahydrofolate. So these are just some of the nuances of folate to think about. So sorry to go on.
No, that's fine. About that. I was going to ask you about BH4. I had it on my notes here.
Sure.
And I'm glad you brought it up.
Do you have other questions or?
No, I just, I ran into it covering the womb and like the development process of the womb and like the timing and so forth. And I ran into BH4 and how it's connected to intellectual disabilities and motor movements, especially gross motor and things like seizures. And I was just like, I bet this is involved, but you confirmed that. So
yeah, the major, disorders that of lack of BH4, usually a person looks like a Parkinson patient. So the syndrome is called Sagawi syndrome, or dopamine responsive dystonia. So the major symptoms you see is more like a Parkinson's patient, but there's other things too, because it's not only dopamine that you've lost serotonin and norepinephrine. So there's a lot, it's really, really important.
Yeah. I with the placenta and neurogenesis, I found that it was important with that fetal ATP that you show.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's very important, and it's a hard molecule to study because it's a fleeting molecule. You know, it's not very stable, and then it's very expensive as a supplement. You know, we used to be able to get some from Switzerland, but I don't think they make it anymore. And so now that's where I originally started, was studying BH4, and there's a medicine called Kuvan, which is synthetic BH4. And it's made for a rare type of phenylalaninemia. Since it's a rare disease, it's extremely expensive. So it's not a practical thing to use, you know. But we, in our studies, we show that it does help, you know, somewhat. But folate helps a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So to get back to the cerebral folate deficiency story, we have to thank Dr. Vincent Raymakers. And he's a pediatric neurologist from Belgium, and he was working in Germany at that time. And he was seeing all these patients that had neurodevelopmental disorders, and he couldn't figure out, you know, what was going on with them, why they had the disorders. He worked them up, and then he teamed up with Dr. Blau, who's in Zurich, Switzerland. And Dr. Blau is probably the most world-renowned scientist on the neurochemistry of the brain. And so what he would do is he sent samples of cerebral spinal fluid. So he did some LPs. This is what happens. If we can't figure it out, we try to do everything. And one of them is to take some fluid from the CSF, the fluid that surrounds the brain, and analyze it and say, is there something there or something not there? And they discovered that these patients had very low folate in their brain. And so this is kind of a new discovery. And you can see that he studied these children over time. And what was interesting is when he looked at some folate levels, they actually dropped over time in some of these kids. Okay. So one of the things that he did was he wanted to know why this was. So he knew that the folate receptor alpha was the major, you know, transport mechanism. So, of course, he said, oh, this must be a genetic problem with the folate receptor alpha. So he sequenced the gene, but he couldn't find any abnormalities. And so he said, you know, it's kind of scratches in his head, huh? So then what happened is he teamed up at the same time. It's an interesting story. At the same time, Dr. Quatros at SUNY Downstate in Brooklyn, New York, was looking at folate, but for birth defects, and trying to figure out why, you know, we didn't get folate into the baby, and they caused birth defects. And what he discovered, at the same time he was looking at birth defects, and he discovered that in these transport mechanisms, that there were these two antibodies running around people's bloods. You know, usually antibodies, you know, attack viruses and bacteria to protect us. But some people have antibodies to themselves, to their own body, and so-called autoimmune diseases. So he found that there was these antibodies that bound to this folate receptor alpha here and stopped it from working. So he was looking at birth defects, and Dr. Raymakers found these patients. So Dr. Raymakers said, well, why don't we test these kiddos for these antibodies? And so then they published their findings really in a really nice paper in the New England Journal of Medicine, you know, probably the best journal in the world, to describe this new phenomenon called cerebral folate deficiency. And they found that these kiddos had particular, you know, symptoms. Starting usually before a year old, they have decreasing head growth. So their brain stopped growing, so their head stopped growing. They'd have neurodevelopmental regression, so they'd lose skills that they had. They'd have dyskinesias, which are movement disorders. Some of them had epilepsy. And then some of them had what we call pyramidal signs, which looks like cerebral palsy. And if they weren't treated, they went on to have visual disturbances and hearing loss. So these kids, they measured this antibody, this folate receptor antibody, and looked at the titers. And we can see that the mean titers in the patients with cerebral folate deficiency were all the way up here, where the control subjects were down here. So the question was, okay, well, how do we treat this? Well, they had also used leucovorin, so that's what we'll talk about a little bit. The thing about leucovorin is, you know, some of it gets turned into 5-methyltetrahydrofolate, but leucovorin is a reduced folate, like 5-methyltetrahydrofolate, and it can go through this reduced folate carrier and go into the brain. Now, of course, it's not that easy. Remember, I said that reduced folate carrier is like a straw. And the levels in the brain are 2 to 3 times out of the blood normally. So what you have to do is get high doses of folate in the blood and push it through the straw to the other side. Some of the science that we looked at is, okay, we know that we have these folate antibodies. Do they correlate with levels of folate in the cerebral spinal fluid? So that's a question people ask. How do you know that they really are doing something? So this is a study by Dr. Rainmakers where he showed that the blocking antibody correlated with levels of folate in the CSF. So we know that correlates. And this is a study we did on autism, where we found that there was a correlation. Although in autism, it's very interesting. We didn't find any of them were below the normal limit. We found a lot of them were low normal, but not below the normal limit. And so there's some subtleties in autism that we think are driving many things. So they first described these patients in the New England Journal of Medicine, and then other papers started to be published. And so this one was cerebral folate deficiency with autism and the response to folinic acid. You know, so they showed that you can use folinic acid to improve symptoms, and they described an individual with autism. So, and then another report came along of autistic symptoms, developmental regression, mental retardation, epilepsy, and dyskinesias in folate deficiency. But again, we started to realize that, oh, there's patients, one of the phenotypes of this is autism. And so, and here's another one where they found low-functioning kids with autism had a cerebral folate deficiency. This is an interesting, in one of their studies, they looked at the folate antibody titer and they looked at aggressive behavior. And you can see that aggressive behavior matches the titer almost exactly.
Wow.
So then, of course, we wanted to know more about treatment. So this is a paper that Dr. Rainmakers did to show if you start treatment, how many people recover from these different symptoms. And see, things like pyramidal tract defects, motor problems, unsteadiness, very much, dyskinesias, so-so, And he found that autism and intellectual disability, not so much. You really had to start early in treatment. One of the amazing, so then they also linked cerebral folate deficiency to mitochondrial disorders, because you remember, I said the folate receptor alpha has to essentially pull folate into the nervous system. So it takes energy. And so if the mitochondria isn't working, it's not going to work. But this is an outstanding study, because what Dr. Rainmaker showed was this is the patient that started when they were diagnosed on the left. And so these are MRIs, and you don't have to be a neuroradiologist to see that this is a really bad MRI, because all this white stuff does not belong there. So that's loss of white matter, the wires that are in the brain. So looks very severe, and you can see almost these holes inside the thalamus and basal ganglia. So most of the time we would say, oh, this is not a recoverable brain. But after 3 years of treatment with some mitochondrial supplements and leucovorin, the brain is almost back to normal.
Wow.
So that's pretty impressive. So going on with the mitochondrial disease, then another paper came out where they found that there was a whole slew of patients with mitochondrial disease that had cerebral folate deficiency. So, you know, the story started building. So what happened is, you know, myself and so this is about 2008. And so, and this is when I was just starting to really treat kids with autism. So I was working with Dr. Rossignol. We were working on some review papers, and we said, well, kids with autism have mitochondrial problems. You know, they have immune problems. How many of these kids are running around our clinic with this folate receptor antibody? He said, you know, we can measure it. We could send it to Dr. Quatros. And so what we did is we systematically offered the test to our patients when they came in. And we made an interesting discovery, which we published in 2012 in Molecular Psychiatry, of the cerebral folate antibodies in autism. And what we discovered was that of the blocking antibody, 60% of the kiddos had the blocking antibody and 50% had the binding antibody. So it wasn't subtle. And if you ask how many had either antibody, 75% had at least one or two antibodies. So that's a lot of kids with autism.
Yeah.
So, you know, of course, we didn't have controls to see if it was, you know, higher than controls. So Dr. Rainmaker had another study where he compared the percentage of kids with autism with the antibodies to controls, which were developmentally delayed controls without autism. And we can see in his study, 47% of them had the antibody, only 3% of the kids with developmental delays, but no autism had the antibodies.
That really discriminates the autism out of it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, extracts it out.
And so then another study was done by at the NIH by Susan Sweeto with using LPs to measure, you know, folate in the CSF of kids with autism. And so what she found is that if you measure the kids that have frankly low CSF levels, it's 18%. So at least 18% have frankly low levels of folate, so below normal. But if you remember when I showed you that other diagram, I said in our study, we found that these kids had kind of more low normal. So this doesn't even include the kids that are low normal. So those that have clearly defined cerebral folate deficiency is 18%, which is a big number. You know, that's, you know, a fifth of kids with autism, you know. So one of the things we said is, well, if the kids have the antibody, do you think that they will respond to treatment? We knew about leucovorin. So what we did is the kids that were positive, 44 of them, we treated with leucovorin 2 milligrams per kilogram. And this was open label, so they knew they were getting it. And then we compare them to something called a waitlist control group. And these were kiddos that were essentially waiting for results. And they neither of them made any other changes. And when they came back to the clinic, we asked them to rate whether things got better or worse on several different aspects. But the most important ones were language, you know, and behavior. And what we found is that in all the language measures, receptive language, expressive language, and verbal communication, there was improvement. So you can use, higher up is improvement. So you can see the black dots are the ones that were treated. So you can just see, you don't even need statistics to see that there's more black dots above the line here than there are clear dots.
Jeez.
We also found that it improved stereotype behavior and attention. And if you look at who improved, you say those that improved in receptive language, about 66%, 67% improved in expressive language, receptive language, and verbal communication. In about a little less, 40% improved on verbal communication, but attention improved in about 60%. Mood about 50%, stereotype behavior about 50%. So it wasn't everybody, but it's a substantial number. So then, you know, so we said, wow, this is really interesting and a potential treatment. But of course, what we did first was something called an open label study. And an open label study means people know that they're getting the drug. So they're biased, right? They say, oh yeah, this thing worked. Yeah, I love this. So we had to do the double-blind placebo control study. And at this time, I was at, whenever we did this study, I was at UT Houston, and I just got recruited to Arkansas Children's Hospital to lead their autism program. So I said, well, the first thing I'm going to do is do a controlled study on leucovorin. And that study was published in 2016. And what we did is we randomized kids, 48 kids, to either receive a placebo or leucovorin. At that time, we were calling it high-dose folinic acid. We don't like using folinic acid anymore because so many people confuse it with folic acid.
Mm-hmm.
So we've kind of changed to just saying leucovorin so there's no confusion. But it's essentially the same molecule. And so in our open label study, we found that language was improving. So that was a great thing because what we could do is, you know, one many problems that we have in studies of autism is that there isn't objective measures of improvement. Many of them are parent questionnaires or, you know, what does the physician think? Is it better? Is it not better? You know, very thing. But for language, you have very, sophisticated measurement tools that can measure many aspects of language, and you can have somebody, a trained person, to actually do the measurement, and they don't know whether the child is on the medication or not. So we can actually put numbers to it. And so what we found is that you can see here in 12 weeks, the ones that were on leucovorin or folinic acid, their verbal communication increased dramatically compared to those that were on placebo. And of course, they were getting speech therapy and everything, so they improved a little bit, but you can see the difference here was dramatic.
Yeah.
And then we asked a question, because in this one we had all comers, those that were positive and negative for the folate autoantibody. And so we asked, does it matter if you're positive or negative? And we found that, in fact, it did. And if you were positive for the folate autoantibody, if you had folinic acid or leucovorin, there was a 77% response rate. And there's an important number called number needed to treat. So that's how many patients you have to treat to get one. And most people, right, you go to the doctor and you think that number should be one, right? You go to the doctor, they give you a drug, you're all better. So people will be surprised to find out in most clinical trials that number is anywhere from 6 to 8. So you have to treat most medications, you have to treat 6 people just to get the effect that you want. So a number of 1.8 is very good. And this is looking at a response criteria of, you know, a very significant response to folic acid. Of course, there's other kids that have more of a lackluster response that are slower. So this is pretty good. Now, what we did is we were able to equate it to how many hours of speech therapy this equaled. It was 177 hours. So that would be 3 hours a week, you know, for a year, or about $7,000 worth of speech therapy for a for $300 worth of a drug. And, you know, it's not only important not trying to, you know, put down speech therapy, but the fact is, you know, we were talking about this, language is so important. And the inability to communicate causes so many problems in children trying to recover and learn. So it's just the fact, if you can get them faster to the place they need to be, they'll be in a lot better shape.
Yeah. And even I think the lack of language, the inability to convey their needs is a big path for self-injurious behavior. I think that's where...
Yes, I do, because they get frustrated. You're absolutely right. And that's what we're learning, right, with the spellers and such, that there's stuff in there.
Yeah.
They can't get it out. And so it's very frustrating for them. So, you know, they can't tell you what they want to say.
Headbanging and stuff.
So that's why language is so important. Now, some people worry about when we start leucovorin, we get some hyperactivity sometimes in the initial few weeks. So we said, well, why don't we study this? Because in our clinical trial, every 3 weeks, we asked about certain adverse effects specifically. And although we didn't ask about hyperactivity, we asked about agitation or excitement. And we can see at 3 weeks, those on leucovorin was about 20%. Those that are on placebo is about 12%. By 6 weeks, they equaled each other at about 22%. And at 9 weeks, and this is what we see at long term, that hyperactivity gets better. See, at 9 weeks, those on leucovorin plummeted to almost zero, whereas the ones on placebo continued to have a higher rate. So, you know, scientifically, you say, well, it's no different than placebo here, if you look at statistics. But, you know, it does tell us that it's pretty much consistent with what you would see, you know, kind of in your normal daily routine, and that with leucovorin, eventually it does get better. So then the other really important aspect is the fact that coming full circle to Dr. Quatros's research, is that these same mechanisms with the folate autoantibody and the folate receptor alpha are on the placenta. So the same mechanisms that takes folate into the brain takes it across the placenta. And what we find is that a percentage, about half of the mothers of kids with the folate autoantibody, have it themselves. So that means they may have had a double whammy. They may have had a problem getting folate into their body before birth and then after birth too. And so to prove this, Dr. Quatros developed an animal model where he takes, you know, pregnant rats and injects the folate autoantibody. And these are all different scales of different tasks, passive avoidance, active avoidance, and such, and the performance on it. And you can see those that did not have that just got a sham did 100%, whereas those that got the antibody either during gestation and pre-weaning, gestation or pre-weaning, that they failed on most of these tasks. And then what he did is he tried to rescue them. And so we can see up here these are a couple of different tasks. So average number of calls is essentially language. Okay. When the folate autoantibody was given to the mother here, you can see that the average number of calls decreased significantly. And if he gave either dexamethasone, a steroid, or folic acid, leucovorin, you can see that all the pups, these are the pups that come out, they're all rescued in that behavior. And the same thing on a behavioral task too, as far as learning. So he showed you can actually rescue these pups when they're during gestation, while they're developing, by giving the mother either high-dose folinic acid, leucovorin, or a steroid to decrease the inflammatory effect of the folate autoantibody. And then he's done other studies where he showed actually that the folate autoantibody causes inflammation. So this is a marker of inflammation, this brown stuff here, and this is the placenta. And so you can see that there's inflammation when you have the folate autoantibody. And then he actually measured folate flux and also showed that folate doesn't get into the fetus when you have these antibodies. One of the other interesting things that we found, which is a little complex, is that we saw that kids, we did a study and we found that the folate autoantibody was correlated with thyroid function. But the thyroid doesn't have the folate receptor alpha on it. And we said, huh, how can this be? And what we did is we actually took fetal tissue and we found, and these brown spots are the folate receptor alpha, that we found that up until 17 weeks gestation, the human thyroid actually does have the folate receptor alpha. So if your mother has the antibody, it's actually going to cause abnormalities in development of the thyroid. So that's a little story of how I got into it in our journey so far and trying to figure out this mystery and figure out how to, you know, really help kids.
That picture shown of the white matter of those brain scans was very wild.
Yeah, that's very impressive.
Yeah, that was a really good finding. And with that language and the communication, do you think that's what it's doing is increasing the white matter tracts from like Wernicke to Broca?
Well, I think, yes. So there's a study, there's a nice study I didn't show where they actually looked at changes in the brain, in the white matter with very sophisticated MRI techniques. And that's what they showed is that the improvement actually paralleled more development of the white matter. And yeah. So one of the things that we have to understand that's common about like language and socialization is that they use parts of the brain that are really far away from each other. They use the back of the brain and the front of the brain. And so when the neurons aren't working well, it's very hard for them to synchronize those long distances. And if the white matter isn't in good shape. So those are probably why we see these symptoms in kids with autism, because those particular higher level functioning, you know, are things that really need these connections from places in the brain that are far away from each other. And it may be why we see some of them have certain splintered skills, right? Because like mathematics is in really just one part of your brain, right? And so that can overdevelop, whereas the rest of the brain isn't developed. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, those distal connections with that white matter tract. Like maybe the arcuate fasciculus with the language tract, I think, maybe is rescued.
Yes, I would think so, yeah.
Wow, that's impressive. Do you find that the leucovorin helps a certain type of the autistic phenotype, like the more severe versus the so-called higher functioning, or is it pretty straightforward across the levels?
It's a great question. One thing we do find is that, one of our first studies suggested that the most severe children and the ones that didn't have language at all, you know, didn't benefit as much. But, you know, that's not what I see in some clinical practice. I see kids that are not talking, start talking, you know. And so it may be an artifact of the instruments we're using, right? Because we can only measure things so far down, you know. So that's the kind of where the clinical trials don't always tell you, you know, exactly what's going on. You're in a very controlled setting, an artificial setting, than the clinical practice. But the one thing that is really interesting is that we had many kids, some that, you know, a lot of people are impressed going from not talking to talking, of course. But we found that even kids that were talking and could have conversations, leucovorin would improve their ability to of their higher level, you know, language abilities. So the tests that we use, you know, get harder and harder and harder, and we can measure some really sophisticated language, you know, abilities. And it seems like it's they get better and better understanding and being able to produce things that are more nuanced as they're treated, even if they're talking to begin with.
Okay, that's impressive. Boy, you answered my questions about the utero and the embryogenesis too, and the neural tube. I found that the B9 and folate is huge for like the neural tube to the crest and neurulation and so forth. But yeah, you hit on those time frames, and I think
So that's, you know, that's what, you know, we're trying to move forward. As I think I told you, I'm going to have a book coming out called The Folate Fix. Has about a dozen stories from parents. So it's not, you know, just me. It's a lot of stories from parents. So you can see what people's journeys are like, you know, and their struggles. And, you know, I hope that will, you know, help parents understand things, understand the struggles that parents go through, you know, to get their kid recovered. So that's one way that we're trying to get the word out. A lot of physicians are very interested in how to use it. So part of that book has kind of a guideline for doing that. We're hoping to get some learning sessions, videos up to be more of a training session, more of a CME course for physicians. And then the other thing, going to what you're talking about with gestation right now, what we're doing is we have a grant from the Arizona State to look at something called transgenerational aspects of the folate autoantibody, because what we find is that these run in families.
So
this may be, you know, one of the mysteries with autism is that there's a very big heritability to it. Yeah. And so everybody equates that to genetics, right?
Man, it's different.
But genetics is only one type of heritability.
Yeah, it's different.
So we're finding these other disorders that are non-genetic, at least not purely genetic, heritable conditions. And of course, the great thing is that we can, if we find them, then we can treat them, and we can treat them from the beginning, you know, before the woman's pregnant, really. That's where you want to start. And the man, we find that also that the folate autoantibody in dad seems to have an effect too. So,
okay.
So both women and men, you know, we want to get them prepared, you know, to become pregnant, because, you know, that's what I try and explain to moms. They have another child that is, as soon as you get pregnant, you're putting a lot of pressure on your body and taking out all the resources. So you got to build up those resources to begin with.
Yeah, the environment of the pregnant mother has vastly changed so much. And I don't want to jump to conclusions here, but maybe there's a role with like spinal bifida.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Most definitely is. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's where Dr. Quatra started out, you know? So it's kind of funny how things have kind of come full circle.
Yes. Yeah. That's so incredible because, wow. How does somebody go about maybe they're autistic, or as you described, they're preparing for pregnancy, or they do have an autistic child, maybe it's a parent. How do they go about trying to receive some leucovorin?
What I usually suggest, like the basic things is, so we have something called the Neurologic Health Foundation, and that's and some great people on there like Jim Adams and such. And we've put together something called the Healthy Child Guide. So you can just Google that, the Neurologic Health Foundation, Healthy Child Guide. And it's a guide we put together based on science of what things you should do to prepare for and to do during your pregnancy to keep yourself healthy. The other thing that's really important is to get a multivitamin that's very complete and also has reduced folates in it. Okay. So one of the problems with many of the prenatal vitamins is that since folic acid is the only thing scientifically that has been shown to reduce neurotube defects, many of the manufacturers won't change to a reduced folate, right? Because legalistically, you know, it's the only thing, folic acid is the only thing that's been proven. We don't have the data on these reduced folates. But we know that these reduced folates are equivalent or better, and probably better. Mm-hmm. Because the other thing we're finding about folic acid is, you know, as I was saying, we only have a limited ability to actually reduce it and make it into its active form. And so this is kind of one of the mysteries, right, is that there's a study that shows that folic acid supplementation prevents autism. Folic acid supplementation during pregnancy, you know, decreases the risk of autism. But then when they measure folate levels in mother's blood, higher folate levels are correlated with greater risk of autism. So that doesn't quite make sense on the surface. And then you find out that those greater levels of folate was unmetabolized folic acid.
Okay.
So that's the problem, is that scientifically too, we're finding that folic acid at high levels will actually inhibit the folate cycle. So when it gets too high, it can have detrimental effects. So that's why we can't just give more folic acid. We have to give what we call reduced folate. So methotetrahydrofolate, tetrahydrofolate, leucovorin, and such. So that those go right into the folate cycle. So we know from experiments that if you, those type of folates don't inhibit the folate cycle. So you can give higher doses.
Wow. Okay.
So so definitely get a prenatal that has reduced folates in it. And there's several good ones that have been made by high quality supplement companies. Look for the Healthy Child Guide, you know, and make sure that you plan things well.
Yeah. There's so much that's come out about that. When could we expect your book, The Folate Fix?
Probably about a month.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, yeah, that's, you can come to my website, autismdiscovery.org, and sign up for a notice when we get it. So,
yeah.
Get notified about things.
I'll spread that on social media, too. And these links and these organizations that you talked about.
Sure. Yeah, we're on Facebook and TikTok. So if you want to follow us, you know, follow, okay, like, and share and all that type of stuff.
For my discussions with you and Nicole, I've learned so much about how these different things with the folinic versus the folate versus the there's just so much that's people, I don't know, it's hard to discover.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to imagine that vitamins are so so complicated.
Yeah, especially the B9. It seems like the B9 is really complicated.
Well, it's important. I think, you know, there's certain, you know, vitamins like B9, B12 and such that are central to so many different mechanisms that they're so important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when you're deficient in it, so much goes wrong, you know?
Yeah. Downstream, it could show up and manifest as a lot of different things, I think. Is there anything else that you would like to share or mention before we wrap up?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think the important thing is, you know, this is a great treatment. You know, I hope people, you know, find out, tell their doctors about it. You know, that's where doctors a lot of times find out about it, about, you know, people bringing them the research, bring the research papers, you know, not just a news article, because and then, you know, I think the always the important thing, you know, of any of the journeys, you know, is for, you know, parents to know that it's not a sprint, it's a marathon, and it takes a lot of work, but you can get there.
Yeah, Nicole mentioned that about the duration of taking these things, and people will give up on them fast.
Yeah. So it's important, you know, to have the guidance of somebody. I know a lot of parents want to do things fast. They say, oh, I can get folinic acid, you know, over the counter. I'm just going to, you know, try it. Oh, you know, I don't want to do the folate autoantibody test. But it's kind of important to do all of these because it's not that simple. And you can fail in many different ways. And you want some type of guidance to know, you know, what is the next step. Many times we find that leucovorin doesn't work alone, that it needs either carnitine, PQQ, vitamin D, you know, other types of things. If there's mitochondrial issues, you have to address those. So it's not so, you know, it's not so easy. And it, this isn't the autism pill, you know, that a lot of patients, you know, I have patients that haven't come back because they told me, well, you didn't give me the autism pill. Well, there's no autism pill. it's a work, it's complex, and it's great to have somebody to guide you through it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for sharing all this information. We'll definitely be on the lookout for your research because I learned about leucovorin from your first episode whenever I asked you what recently are you most interested in. This was the first thing that you mentioned. And then obviously the last couple of weeks it's hit the news. So this is really fantastic.
Yeah, we were very lucky that, yeah, CBS, you know, picked it up. And we've gotten a lot of good press from that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll do my best of sharing this information to you because I think it's worthy with that low risk, high reward type of thing.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Fry, thank you for joining again and looking forward to maybe another future interaction with you.
Sure.
All the time.
Yeah. Always happy to be on, spread the good word. So
yeah, yeah, yeah. We appreciate that. Well, have a good day, and thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
Thanks.
Bye.